Soon after the militants took over Fallujah, the videotaped beheadings began. 1 week after the U.S. withdrawal from the city, the body of Nick Berg, a 26-year-old telecommunications engineer from Pennsylvania, was discovered dangling upside down beneath a highway overpass between Fallujah and Baghdad. His head was found discarded on the ground nearby, blood matting his hair and beard. Days later, a video surfaced showing his beheading, in which it was later confirmed that Zarqawi had personally wielded the knife. A statement read out immediately before the murder made specific reference to the recent revelation that U.S. troops in Iraq had tortured and otherwise abused insurgent prisoners in their custody. The dignity of the Muslim men and women in Abu Ghraib is not redeemed except by blood and souls, the masked militant intoned. Until the West withdrew from Iraq, he said, you will receive nothing from us but coffin after coffin slaughtered in this way. By the end of the insurgent occupation of Fallujah, in November 2004, at least 8 more foreign hostages had been decapitated. Many of their deaths, like that of Nick Berg, were broadcast online. The body of one Japanese hostage was discovered wrapped in an American flag. It is a depressing fact that these videos have become as commonplace as they are programmatic, as predictable as a bad horror story, but incomparably worse for being real. A row of jihadists, masked or hooded like assassins, lines up before a black banner. In front of them, another figure, kneeling, quaking, in an orange jumpsuit, a deliberate visual reference, as we have seen, to the conditions of detention at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. The victim makes a brief statement identifying himself, name, nationality, place of birth, religion. A militant reads a longer, bloodier, more apocalyptic speech. Then another pulls a knife. Methodically, he saws off the victim's head and holds it up for the camera. In the final frames, the head is seen resting on the corpse's back. Somewhere nearby lies the instrument of death, often displayed propped up on the body itself. Zarqawi's bloodthirsty admirers reveled in these displays of depravity, which soon earned him the nickname Sheikh of the Slaughterers. When the videos dried up in late 2004, following the liberation of Fallujah, jihadists took to online forums to complain. One anonymous user lamented, "We used to start our day by watching a slaughter scene, for it is no secret to the knowledgeable that it stimulates and appeases the contents of the chest. Many of those who suffer from high blood pressure and diabetes have complained about the cease of these operations, for they were tranquilizing them. Someone told me, and I believe he speaks the truth, that he does not eat his food until he has watched a beheading scene, even if it were replayed or old." However, not everyone who shared Zarqawi's goals was so enamored of his methods. Local insurgent leaders complained bitterly that his brutality was alienating international sympathy for their cause. In July 2004, the third month of the Republic of al-Zarqawi in Fallujah, reports surfaced that some Iraqi resistance factions had cut their ties with Zarqawi because of the unacceptable level of civilian casualties. The Sunni Association of Muslim Scholars in Iraq, vocal supporters of the anti-American insurgency, condemned the beheadings of foreign hostages as violations of Sharia. The Egyptian Sunni cleric Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who once described Palestinian suicide bombings as evidence of God's justice, likened Zarqawi to the Kharijites, an early Islamic sect infamous for a simplistic and faulty reading of scripture that led some of their number to murder the Caliph Ali. Even Zarqawi's old Jordanian mentor, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, soon became critical of his actions. In July 2004, Maqdisi posted on his website an article entitled Al-Zarqawi, Aid and Advice. In it, he accused Zarqawi of defiling the jihad and its honorable image with attacks that killed Muslim civilians who were not engaged in aiding the infidels. This article came out shortly before Maqdisi was moved from prison to house arrest, which in the view of at least one commentator implies that it may have been published as part of a secret deal with the Jordanian authorities. But as we shall see, Maqdisi was far from done criticizing his former protege. Despite his efforts to create a pipeline through Syria, and despite the outpouring of admiration for his efforts on jihadist social media, the inflow of foreign fighters into Zarqawi's organization was still not enough to satisfy his grandiose vision of an apocalyptic battle for control of the Middle East. In a statement published in January 2004, he questioned the masculinity of those who would not join him. "The gates of heaven are open," he said. "If you are unwilling to be one of the knights of war, make way for the women, so they can run the war, and you take the cooking utensils and makeup in their stead. If you are not women in turbans and beards, go to the horses and seize their harnesses and their reins." In September, in the midst of Fallujah's Republic of al-Zarqawi phase, he continued in a more explicitly apocalyptic vein. "My nation, the nation of the sword and the pen, why is it that your sword is now broken and your pen has been laid down? You used to be prouder than the stars, and have now become downtrodden under the feet of the invaders and under the hooves of the usurper's horses. My dear nation, my words to you today are laden with sorrow. Don't you hear the serpents hissing as they wind their way in the darkness of your apathy in order to assassinate your dawn?" Far more severe, however, and far more dangerous to Zarqawi's image in Iraq, was his failure to attract local recruits. Besides their natural revulsion for his methods, Zarqawi's naked sectarianism alienated many Iraqi Sunnis. In contrast to Zarqawi's native Jordan, where practically everyone belongs to the Sunni tradition, around half of Iraqi Muslims, and a clear majority of Iraqi Arabs, are Shia. By the standards of the Arab world, there is strikingly little animosity between the groups. Even in 2012, after years of sectarian attacks and a Shia-led government that was itself widely criticized for being divisive, only 14% of Iraqi Sunnis said that Shias were not Muslims, compared with 43% in Jordan and 53% in Egypt. Indeed, in Iraq, the two communities are to an extent intermingled. Few Iraqis wanted to attack people who for centuries had been their neighbors, let alone their friends, wives, fathers, and mothers. Of course, this was not how Zarqawi saw things. He preferred to blame the dearth of Iraqis in his organization on their lack of expertise or experience or farsightedness, and on what he saw as their timidity. "The Iraqi brothers still prefer safety," he told Osama bin Laden in a letter. "Sometimes the groups have boasted among themselves that not one of them has been killed or captured. We have told them that safety and victory are incompatible." Nonetheless, among Iraq's contingent of foreign terrorists, Zarqawi fashioned a leading role for himself. Fighters trying to reach the country depended upon his Syrian pipeline. Once in Iraq, they relied upon his network's superior contacts and intelligence gathering capability. In effect, then, Zarqawi had made himself an emir of the strangers. By the fall of 2004, Jordanian intelligence called him the head of the pyramid of terrorism in Iraq, and spoke of him as a potential rival to bin Laden. Yet Zarqawi remained deeply frustrated by what he saw as his lack of progress. Fallujah was not turning out to be the secure foothold the militants had hoped for. Throughout the summer and into the fall of 2004, the city came under increasing pressure from U.S. forces, eager for revenge for the dramatic reversals they had suffered there earlier in the year. He continued to be unsatisfied with the pace of recruitment, and his fundraising efforts, too, remained rudimentary. If admittedly ingenious, involving, for example, having associates with clean records buy ordinary cars in Jordan and drive them over the border to be sold for cash in Iraq. By mid-2004, Tawhid wal-Jihad's coffers were running low. It was a far cry from the millions of dollars al-Qaeda was capable of raising from wealthy Saudis and other donors, and the hundreds of recruits that the al-Qaeda name drew in. With that kind of backing, Zarqawi might have thought he could solve his recruitment woes and intensify still further his battle against the Americans, the emerging Iraqi government, and the Shia. Unfortunately for him, al-Qaeda appeared to be ignoring his advances. Around the beginning of 2004, just over 4 years after he had first met Osama bin Laden and declined to pledge allegiance to him, Zarqawi had once again reached out to the al-Qaeda leader and Ayman al-Zawahiri. In a letter to them, he painted a bleak picture of the insurgency's future if drastic action were not taken soon. Iraq's Sunnis, he said, were rudderless and lost. Their clerics were interested only in ceremonies, while the Muslim Brotherhood had forsworn jihad in order to grub for subordinate political power in a Shia-dominated government. Iraqi fighters were inexperienced and overly cautious. Foreign fighters were too few in number compared to the enormity of the expected battle. All the while, the United States was tightening its grip around the throats of the Mujahideen. Worst of all, Zarqawi claimed, the Shia were on the march. The unhurried observer and inquiring onlooker will realize that Shiism is the looming danger and the true challenge, he wrote. People without exception know that most of the Mujahideen who have fallen in war have done so at the hands of these people. The Shia were already fighting on the side of the Americans, he told the al-Qaeda leadership. Sooner or later, they would take over the running of the country for good. Together with the hated regimes of Iran and Syria, they would form a Shia crescent from the Gulf to the Mediterranean, a danger against which even secular rulers like King Abdullah of Jordan and Egypt's Hosni Mubarak had warned, albeit for security rather than sectarian reasons. When that happened, the Mujahideen would have to give up and find another theater of jihad, just as they had done in Afghanistan. Zarqawi proposed a full-blooded sectarian holy war against the Shia, declaring such a jihad would not only strike a blow for so-called true Islam, it would galvanize the Sunnis themselves and propel them into the fight. Al-Qaeda need not be squeamish about the probable consequences. God's religion is more precious than lives and souls, Zarqawi wrote. There has to be some sacrifice for this religion. Let blood be spilled, and we will soothe and speed those who are good to their paradise. Once again, this is the old Takfiri claim, traceable to Ibn Taymiyyah and the Mongols. It doesn't matter whom we kill or in what numbers, because God will send the good dead to heaven and the bad to hell. Finally, Zarqawi told bin Laden and Zawahiri his true demand, to unite his own organization with al-Qaeda. This is our vision, and we have explained it. This is our path, and we have made it clear. If you agree with us on it, if you adopt it as a program and road, and if you are convinced of the idea of fighting the sects of apostasy, we will be your readied soldiers, working under your banner, complying with your orders, and indeed swearing fealty to you publicly and in the news media, vexing the infidels and gladdening those who preach the oneness of God. On that day, the believers will rejoice in God's victory. If things appear otherwise to you, we are brothers, and the disagreement will not spoil our friendship. This is a cause in which we are cooperating for the good and supporting jihad. Awaiting your response, may God preserve you as keys to good and reserves for Islam and its people. American intelligence sources told the media that they believed al-Qaeda had rejected Zarqawi's proposal. That decision would have made a lot of sense. The al-Qaeda leader had rejected Zarqawi's expressions of violent takfirism 4 years before at their meeting in Kandahar. It is hard to believe that he would have been any more receptive now that the Jordanian was proposing a full-scale sectarian civil war. But that was not the only consideration in play. Al-Qaeda, as a whole, faced tough challenges by 2004. Many of its senior leaders had been killed in Afghanistan or arrested in Pakistan or Iran. Its affiliates had recently carried out bloody attacks in Bali, Spain, and Saudi Arabia, but the organization possessed barely a toehold in Iraq, which was quickly becoming the center of gravity for the global jihad. More alarmingly still, Zarqawi was now being spoken of as a potential rival to bin Laden, a threat that al-Qaeda would need to neutralize quickly. The surest way of doing that might be to make him a subordinate, which is exactly what Zarqawi was proposing. On October 17, 2004, Zarqawi announced that he had pledged bayat to bin Laden. Tawhid wal-Jihad would henceforth be called Qaidat al-Jihad fi Bilad al-Rafidain, the base of jihad in the Land of Two Rivers, better known in the West as al-Qaeda in Iraq. In his statement announcing the allegiance, Zarqawi struck a triumphant tone. "Hold fast to the rope of God, and you shall not be divided," he wrote, quoting the Quran. "This is undoubtedly an indication that victory is approaching, God willing, and that it represents a return to the glorious past, a caliphate that follows the guidance of prophethood." Initially, the authenticity of this statement was called into question. Iraqis were bound to view the insurgency less sympathetically if, instead of a legitimate struggle against an occupier, it was seen as merely another battlefield in bin Laden's terror campaign against the West. Some militants therefore dismissed reports of Zarqawi's pledge of allegiance to al-Qaeda as American propaganda designed to discredit their cause. But the bayat was real. Bin Laden confirmed it in an adulatory audio message 2 months later. "The warrior commander and honored comrade Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and the groups who joined him are the best of the community that is fighting for the sake of the word of God. Their courageous operations against the Americans and against the apostate Alawi government," a reference to the Iraqi Prime Minister Ayed Alawi, "have gladdened us. We in the al-Qaeda organization very much welcome their union with us. This is a tremendous step on the path to the unification of the efforts fighting for the establishment of a state of truth and for the uprooting of the state of the lie. Know that the warrior comrade, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, is the emir of al-Qaeda in the land of the Tigris and the Euphrates, and the comrades in the organization there must obey him." At a stroke, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had stamped his organization with the most feared and revered brand in contemporary global jihad and secured access to deeper pockets and wider pools of volunteers than his group had ever had before. For himself, he had gained still greater personal notoriety and global reach and cemented his authority as emir of all foreign jihadis in Iraq. But there was a crucial difference between al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and al-Qaeda in Iraq. However much bin Laden might from time to time have antagonized the Taliban during his second Afghan sojourn, he remained their honored guest. Zarqawi did not enjoy anything like that level of esteem among the leaders of Iraq's insurgency. His methods showed little consideration for the Iraqi people on whose behalf the local insurgents claimed to be fighting. As 2004 drew to a close, the Jordanians' welcome in Iraq was wearing thin. In November, some 12,000 American troops, alongside British and Iraqi forces, descended on Fallujah and began clearing the city of militants house by house in the bloodiest single battle of the entire Iraq War. Hundreds of insurgents were killed or captured in the fighting. In the south of the city, U.S. Marines, raiding al-Qaeda's headquarters, captured page after page of written instructions from Zarqawi himself. The liberation of Fallujah left the insurgency once again without a secure base for its operations. The debacle also dealt a heavy blow to the foreign fighters' already tarnished image among ordinary Iraqis. Not only had these men brutalized the local population with beheadings and summary violence, many of them had simply fled before the U.S. advance, deserting the people they had promised to defend. In keeping with his sectarian worldview, Zarqawi blamed the Shia fighters who had participated in the battle on the same side as the Americans. In his mind, this was yet more proof that Iraq's Shia Muslims were out for Sunni blood. Shia political leaders, for their part, were about to consolidate their power in dramatic fashion. Elections for national and regional parliaments had been scheduled for January 30, 2005. Support for the elections fractured largely along ethnic and sectarian lines. Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the most senior Shia theologian in Iraq, told his followers that it was their religious duty to participate, and he set about organizing a big tent coalition of Shia parties, the United Iraqi Alliance. Kurdish parties, who also stood to benefit, joined Shia leaders in endorsing the elections. By contrast, prominent Sunni Arab groups, including the Association of Muslim Scholars, called for a boycott. Osama bin Laden also condemned the elections, maintaining that they were ordained under man-made laws that permitted non-fundamentalist candidates to run for office. Zarqawi went further. His organization, curiously using its old name of Tawhid wal Jihad, issued a specific death threat against all election officials and their families. 1 week before the elections, he published an audio message denouncing democracy as a system in which man is deified, worshipped, and obeyed, not God. A person has the right to believe whatever he pleases, and nothing is sacred. His mentor, Makdisi, had published a book, Democracy is a Religion, making much the same argument. Lovers of democracy, Zarqawi insisted, were just as ignorant and sinful as the children of Israel who worshipped the golden calf before Moses set them straight. The Sunni Arab boycott skewed the election results dramatically. In Anbar province, for example, turnout languished at just 2%. Mass non-participation left Sunni parties with just 6 seats in the National Assembly, compared to 140 for Ayatollah Sistani's United Iraqi Alliance bloc and 75 for the Kurdistan Alliance. On the other hand, Shia participation was apparently little influenced by threats from Zarqawi and others. Even without the bulk of the Arab Sunni population, turnout across the country at 58% compared favorably with the 61% Americans had achieved in their most recent presidential election 3 months before, itself a 36-year record. Insurgent attacks did take place, but thanks in part to an unprecedented security operation, with 130,000 Iraqi troops deployed to guard the country's 5,200 polling stations. The militants failed to disrupt the vote in any meaningful way. The result was a government in which most of the major posts, including president and prime minister, were occupied by Kurds or Shia, and a constitutional drafting process in which Sunnis would have disproportionately little input. Sunnis quickly came to rue their decision to boycott the vote. They would not make the same mistake next time, no matter what Zarqawi or anyone might say. At the same time, the pressure on Zarqawi personally was beginning to ramp up. It emerged that in late 2004, in the aftermath of the recapture of Fallujah by coalition forces, he had actually been arrested in the city by Iraqi police, held for 2 or 3 hours, and interrogated. Then, apparently failing to recognize the most wanted terrorist in Iraq, and satisfied with whatever story he had spun for them, the Iraqis had let him go. It was a frustrating moment, but a more sophisticated manhunt was already underway. Following the arrest of Saddam Hussein in December 2003, and the capture or killing of many of the regime henchmen depicted on the notorious deck of playing cards handed out to coalition troops, many of the special operators, intelligence agents, and other assets previously engaged in that pursuit were free to focus on tracking down Zarqawi. On February 20, 2005, someone in Zarqawi's organization tipped off U.S. forces that the emir was due to attend a meeting in Ramadi and would be getting there by pickup truck along a particular stretch of Riverside Highway. As they got into their vehicle, Zarqawi and his driver must have missed the tiny speck of an RQ-7 Shadow reconnaissance drone high above, recording their every move. Somewhere along the highway, Delta Force operators threw up a roadblock in his path, but the pickup charged through. With the Deltas in hot pursuit, Zarqawi's vehicle now approached a second checkpoint, manned by Army Rangers. One of the Americans trained a heavy machine gun on the rapidly approaching truck. The gunner requested permission to open fire, but his commanding officer, no doubt haunted by the possibility of yet more civilian casualties, wanted a positive ID. It was too late. The pickup sped past this second group of Americans, close enough for them to note Zarqawi's Black Hawk tactical vest, his American assault weapon, and the look of panic on his face. The Deltas were now only a few seconds behind. Zarqawi could be heard screaming at his driver to exit the highway onto a side road, then to stop the truck. He leapt out of the pickup and fled on foot into a town. Out of the vehicle, the American seized the driver, a laptop with a treasure trove of information, and $100,000 in cash. But the Amir of the strangers was gone. 3 months later, in Qaim, a desert town in Anbar province, a stone's throw from the Syrian border, his hideout took a hit from a U.S. airstrike. Zarqawi was wounded, apparently seriously enough to require hospitalization. An Al-Qaeda in Iraq spokesman urged followers to pray for the healing of our Sheikh Abu Musab al-Zarqawi for an injury he suffered in the path of God. Later, Iraqi and U.S. forces reportedly stormed the hospital in Ramadi, where he was being treated. Once again, however, Zarqawi disappeared. A week after the airstrike, in a public audio message addressed to bin Laden, he brushed off rumors that he had been critically wounded or even killed, assuring supporters that "my wounds were light." He signed off with unusual subservience, from a private to a commander. In reality, his relationship with the Al-Qaeda leadership was far from supplicatory or stable. While Zarqawi crisscrossed Iraq by road, meeting with local commanders, recording vitriolic audio statements, furtively avoiding detection by airborne or ground-level spies, bin Laden and Zawahiri crouched impassively in their Pakistani safe houses, brooding over the news delivered by Al-Qaeda's network of couriers and growing more agitated by the day. Never had the contrast in temperament between bin Laden and Zarqawi been clearer or more consequential. Al-Qaeda had no use for a sectarian bloodbath, still less an insurgency that appeared to go out of its way to alienate the Iraqi public with its brutalizing methods. Zarqawi's reckless conduct threatened to create both, and yet he still represented Al-Qaeda's only foothold in what by 2005 had become one of the most important theaters of jihad worldwide. The rank and file adored him, and his swagger and fury, however antagonizing to the top brass, were good for recruitment. Dealing with him was a delicate matter for Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden had become so vexed with the issue that he had created a committee of senior operatives to figure out how to handle it. Sometime during 2005, he assigned Abdul Hadi al-Iraqi, the only Iraqi in Al-Qaeda's Shura Council, as a liaison who might talk some sense into Zarqawi. It surprised virtually no one that al-Iraqi failed to make much progress. In July 2005, Ayman al-Zawahiri sent Zarqawi a cease and desist letter. Missives among the upper echelon, still hand-delivered by courier, had become an art form of their own. With Edwardian politesse, Zawahiri began by propitiating Zarqawi with praise for his historic and God-given mission. Then he got down to brass tacks. He could only observe from afar, he wrote, but that did give him the advantage of perspective. In contrast to Zarqawi's reckless approach of lashing out in all directions at once, Zawahiri offered a chillingly intricate sequential analysis of the conflict. The jihad in Iraq requires several incremental goals. The first stage, expel the Americans from Iraq. The second stage, establish an Islamic Authority or emirate. The third stage, extend the jihad wave to the secular countries neighboring Iraq. The fourth stage, it may coincide with what came before, the clash with Israel. Based on this analysis, clearly Iraq was still in the first stage. What was needed was a leader who could unite all Muslims against the American occupation. The Mujahideen must maintain popular support and avoid any action that the masses do not understand or approve. there was a salutary lesson, Zawahiri wrote, in the fate of the Taliban, who had systematically alienated most of the Afghan population and then found that they had few supporters when the Americans invaded. Zarqawi should not dwell on arcane theological differences with mainstream Sunni clerics. He would do well to remember that his own hero, Nur ad-Din Zangi, followed the Ash'ari school, a relatively tolerant and broad-minded creed, much criticized by the more rigid Salafis and Wahhabis. Moreover, he should stop releasing those gruesome beheading videos, scenes of slaughter, Zawahiri called them, because the people would never find these palatable. Besides, it would be just as easy to kill the captives by bullet. Above all, Zawahiri told Zarqawi he should stop attacking the Shia, however wrong-headed and dangerous they may be. These actions served only to alienate the majority of Sunnis and distract attention from the main task of defeating the Americans. Whatever guilt Shia clerics and leaders might bear, scholars agreed that ordinary Shia were forgiven because of their ignorance. Moreover, there was no practical way of meting out death to every Shia in Iraq, so sectarian killings would merely alienate a powerful plurality of Iraqis. Besides, Al-Qaeda needed to keep the Iranian regime on side if they were to stand any chance of releasing their comrades held prisoner there. In short, there was little to be lost in refraining from attacking the Shia, and much to be gained. Considering the scope of Zarqawi's transgressions, this was a very mild rebuke indeed. But it had been a long time in coming. Zawahiri was not the only senior figure to complain. Around the same time, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi gave an interview to Al Jazeera in which he pointed out that even Zarqawi's fiery fundamentalist idol, the medieval scholar Ibn Taymiyyah, had stopped short of declaring every Shia Muslim an unbeliever. "Even if our Sunni brothers in Iraq have many justifications," Maqdisi told Al Jazeera, "this does not justify blowing up mosques. Permitting the blood of the Shiites is a mistake in which jihad fighters had best not become entangled." Around a week later, Maqdisi gave another interview, this time to the pan-Arab daily newspaper Al-Hayat, in which he added that suicide bombings were not permissible if the jihad fighter could kill the enemy with a Kalashnikov or a pistol. These rebukes stung Zarqawi, but failed to induce the hoped-for repentance. He described Maqdisi's renewed criticism as a new arrow aimed at our hearts. On suicide bombings, he averred that he had agreed when I was in Afghanistan during the communist invasion, but had changed his mind during his second tour in 1999. "Not only did I adopt the idea that suicide bombings are permissible," he said, "but I see fit to advocate them as commendable." To the warnings about fighting the Shia, Zarqawi paid even less heed. In fact, he was about to double down on his call for sectarian warfare. In the spring of 2005, Al-Qaeda in Iraq seemed to have found itself a new Fallujah. Tal Afar, a largely Turkmen town in the far north of the country, about one-quarter Shia and the rest Sunni. Natives of the city would later fill some of the top leadership spots in the Islamic State of Iraq. AQI took advantage of the sectarian divide to carve Tal Afar into what one American commander called two armed camps in direct military competition with one another. Al-Qaeda terrorists would abduct and behead Shia, leaving their bodies outside the Ottoman castle where the town's entirely Shia police force had taken shelter. The police, for their part, reciprocated in kind, dispatching what have been called death squads to cut down Sunnis. By late summer, the spiraling violence had become intolerable. On September 3rd, U.S. troops entered the old city, Al-Qaeda's stronghold, with overwhelming force. American ground forces crept across rooftops so as not to set off explosive traps left for them in the streets below, while Apache gunships rained rocket fire on the Al-Qaeda positions from above. At the height of the battle, which he monitored from a safe house well clear of the front lines, Zarqawi issued a face-saving statement. martyrdom operations are ongoing at Tal Afar. In addition to planting explosive devices and luring the enemy into street fights, we are avoiding civilian casualties between Muslim women and children. We withdrew from some neighborhoods just for this purpose alone. In truth, what Al-Qaeda was facing in Tal Afar was nothing less than a rout. American commanders put the number of dead fighters at 151. The rest, as in Fallujah 1 year before, had fled. Once again, Zarqawi blamed the defeat on the Shia, whom he accused of declaring war on Sunnis and of carrying out atrocities, including the rape of Sunni women. He used the defeat at Tal Afar as an excuse for his own public declaration of all-out warfare against all Shiites in Iraq. He warned his adversaries, "Take care, for we swear that we shall offer you no mercy." The response was swift and damning, even from vocally pro-insurgent Sunni clerics. The Association of Muslim Scholars in Iraq called Zarqawi's declaration dangerous and demanded that he retract his threats lest they damage the image of jihad and lead to further bloodshed of innocent Iraqis. The jihadi theorist Abu Basir al-Tartusi, echoing Zawahiri and Maqdisi, said that he knew of no highly regarded ulama, clerics of Islam, who have issued a fatwa permitting the killing of any Shiite merely because he is a Shiite. Some Iraqi Sunnis now openly defied Zarqawi. When Al-Qaeda in Iraq put up posters threatening to behead anyone who voted in the upcoming constitutional referendum, imams in Diluya, north of Baghdad, went around the town tearing the notices down and ripping them into shreds. Still, Zarqawi refused to repent. An Al-Qaeda in Iraq statement published on October 21st said, "We do not understand why this ferocious campaign against Mujahideen is occurring at the present time. This is exactly what the cross worshippers and their collaborators," a reference to the Americans and the Iraqis who worked with them, "want to see." Within a month, Al-Qaeda suicide bombers had struck two Shia mosques in Khanaqin, a town northeast of Baghdad, close to the Iranian frontier, killing at least 74 worshippers as they knelt for Friday prayers. Attacks like these infuriated the Al-Qaeda establishment, but in a sense, Zarqawi was merely giving his backers what they demanded. On the one hand, the Assad regime, which facilitated Al-Qaeda in Iraq operationally, was delighted with the chaos Zarqawi was able to create using fighters supplied through the Syrian pipeline. On the other, the wealthy Saudis and others who lined Zarqawi's pockets were desperate to ensure that Iraq did not fall into the hands of the Shia, who were sure to align themselves with Iran and against Saudi Arabia. Such donors evidently saw horrific violence against innocent Shia Muslims as the way to ensure that this outcome did not materialize. At the same time, Zarqawi continued to nurse his hatred against his oldest enemy, the Jordanian state. In August, his operatives in the port of Aqaba, in the southwest of the country, had fired a number of missiles from a World War II-era Soviet Katyusha truck-mounted rocket launcher. One had killed a Jordanian soldier and narrowly missed two U.S. Navy ships in the harbor. Another had landed over the border on a road in Israel, wounding a taxi driver. But this paled in comparison to what was to come. On November 9th, suicide bombers sent by Zarqawi staged a far bigger assault in Amman, blowing themselves up at three hotels and killing 60 people, the vast majority of them Jordanian Sunni Arabs. The deadliest blast at the Radisson, the same hotel that would have been targeted in the failed Millennium Plot, tore through a wedding reception, killing almost 40 guests, including the fathers of the bride and groom. The two suicide bombers assigned to the Radisson were themselves a married couple from Fallujah. In a room full of joyous singing and dancing, the male terrorist unleashed a deadly burst of fire and shrapnel. "Everything was white at our wedding," the groom later recalled, "but it all turned red because of the blood." Within 24 hours, Al-Qaeda in Iraq had claimed responsibility for the Amman atrocities, The group said the attacks had been aimed at some of the dens that have been implanted in the land of the Muslims, some of the hotels that the tyrant of Jordan had converted into a backyard for the enemies of the religion. What Zarqawi seemed to be alleging was that the hotels had been targeted because they accommodated Western officials. It was a claim that fooled almost no one. Instead, Jordanians immediately recognized the attacks for what they really were, a savage, cowardly assault on the softest of targets. A few days after the bombings, 100,000 people took to the streets of Amman in protest. Jordanians shouted that Zarqawi was a coward who deserved to burn in hell. Once again, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi gave an interview to Al Jazeera, condemning his former protege. Evidently alarmed at the scale of the revulsion, Zarqawi went into full public relations damage control mode. In a written statement issued a day later, he asserted that the hotels were centers for waging war against Islam and for supporting the Crusader presence in Mesopotamia and the Arabian Peninsula, and supporting the presence of the Jews in Palestine, and the favorite work locations for foreign intelligence services. Later, he claimed that the deaths of Jordanian Sunnis were an unintended and unexpected occurrence. Addressing his fellow Jordanians directly, he added, "If we wanted to spill your blood, God forbid, it would have been simpler by far to have those martyrs blow themselves up in public places where hundreds of people congregate and present such easy targets, such as the Hashemiyah Square, the Al-Abdali complex, or commercial centers such as the Safeway, etc." Osama bin Laden, for his part, is said to have been furious about the bombings. But given Zarqawi's importance to the jihad in Iraq, it was still too risky to allow this frustration to show in al-Qaeda's public pronouncements. On November 18th, the very day tens of thousands of Jordanians marched in protest, an al-Qaeda mouthpiece, the Global Islamic Media Front, characterized Zarqawi as one of the commanders of the global jihad, standing alongside Ayman al-Zawahiri, Mullah Omar, and bin Laden. In private, al-Qaeda severely rebuked its wayward commander. Mahmoud, the former senior member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who was subsequently to serve as bin Laden's factotum, wrote to Zarqawi in December, expressing concerns similar to those Zawahiri had raised a few months earlier. Mahmoud was an old acquaintance of Zarqawi's from his Herat days, and unlike Zawahiri, he did not seem concerned with wounding Zarqawi's pride. Zarqawi's perilous and ruinous conduct, Mahmoud wrote, was producing corruption and havoc. He bluntly commanded the Jordanian to remedy the deficiency. As a subordinate, Zarqawi must consult the leadership before making big decisions, by which Mahmoud meant declaring war against the Shia and expanding the jihad to neighboring countries like Jordan. He must forthwith send emissaries to Waziristan to meet with al-Qaeda's leaders. This was, Mahmoud wrote, more important than preparing and sending the brothers for some operations like the recent operation of the hotels in Amman. Truly, I am not joking. Once again, this dispute prefigured later conflicts within al-Qaeda. 8 years later, Zawahiri was to order Zarqawi's successor, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to keep his own operations within Iraq and let al-Nusra take care of Syria. His wishes would largely be ignored. In his desperation to rein in Zarqawi's damaging conduct, Mahmoud seemed out of his depth, his demands taking on an almost farcical tone. He ordered Zarqawi to stop killing and alienating Sunni tribal leaders and scholars who did not agree with him. Instead, Zarqawi must consult with them, win them over, say nice things. It was supremely important that the people view the Mujahideen with affection, not merely as people of killing, slaughter, blood, cursing, insult, and harshness. Mahmoud urged Zarqawi to leave the path of excuses and take steps to rein in his behavior. Finally, he issued a threat. "Anyone who commits tyranny and aggression upon the people and causes corruption within the land and drives people away from us and our faith and our jihad and from the religion and the message that we carry then he must be taken to task, and we must direct him to what is right, just, and for the best. Otherwise, we would have to push him aside and keep him away from the sphere of influence and replace him and so forth. For this is an important matter. The considered consultative approach Mahmud advocated was laughably far removed from the intentions of al-Qaeda's most unruly operative. 2 months later, massive explosions ripped apart the gilded dome of the Golden Mosque in Samarra, one of Shia Islam's holiest places, killing dozens of people and setting off a tidal wave of reprisals that would claim thousands more lives across the country. As Iraq stared into the abyss, Zarqawi's status in the insurgency became less and less clear. In January of 2006, 1 month before the Golden Dome fell, al-Qaeda in Iraq joined five other insurgent groups to form an entity called the Mujahideen Shura Council. Leadership of the council was placed in the hands of an Iraqi, Abdullah bin Rashid al-Baghdadi, said to be the same man who, as Omar al-Baghdadi, was to become the first emir of the Islamic State of Iraq. Formally, at least, Zarqawi was excluded from the council's top table, but al-Qaeda in Iraq was still the council's most powerful member group. Indeed, some of the council's statements were still issued on al-Qaeda in Iraq letterhead. Among foreign terrorists in Iraq, the emir of the strangers remained the most respected jihadist in the country. One veteran jihadi would later claim that Zarqawi had been forced to step down as leader of the foreign fighters sometime in March. But the next month, Zarqawi issued a video, the first in which he is known to have appeared, announcing that the council would be the starting point for establishing an Islamic state. We hope to God that within 3 months from now, the environment will be favorable for us to announce an Islamic emirate. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi made many enemies with his reckless campaign to pit Sunni against Shia in Iraq, but in the end, his most potent enemy would prove to be the Sunnis themselves. To an outside observer, Zarqawi seemed to go out of his way to alienate Sunni leaders, particularly tribal sheikhs. In February of 2005, he openly accused tribal elders of standing as a stumbling block in the path of jihad and threatened reprisals. Later, he made good on these threats, assassinating dozens of leaders and moderate Sunni clerics. Over the course of that year, Sunnis began to retaliate. The murder of one local sheikh prompted his tribe to round up, try, and publicly execute several foreign members of al-Qaeda in Iraq. An Iraqi intelligence official told the New York Times, "The tribes are fed up with al-Qaeda, and they will not tolerate any more." Meanwhile, AQI had also begun assassinating more moderate Sunni religious figures in a campaign known as the Culture of the Silencers for the weapons typically used to carry out the killings. In Anbar province, between 2005 and 2007, the group murdered around 250 scholars, clerics, and khatibs, preachers who deliver Friday sermons. Hamza al-Isawi, the Grand Imam of Fallujah, a scholar well known throughout Iraq for his religious writings, spoke out against extremism during his Friday sermon. The same day, he was shot dead. In Ramadi, gunmen killed a local imam, Abdul Alim al-Sadi, the brother of the Grand Mufti of Iraq. Militants attempted to assassinate Dr. Khalid Suleiman al-Fadawi, a popular member of parliament, formerly in charge of Sunni religious endowments in Anbar, and succeeded in killing two of his bodyguards. Fadawi himself would later be assassinated in a suicide bombing at a Sunni mosque in Baghdad in 2011. Sunnis of all persuasions, as well as a number of fellow militants, grew appalled at AQI's excesses. Groups including Ansar al-Sunnah wrote repeatedly to bin Laden himself, warning the emir of the damage being done to his cause. These groups would eventually join together in the Jihad and Reform Front, with the express purpose of opposing the Islamic State of Iraq. From the latter half of 2005 onward, In a movement later known as the Sunni Awakening, Sunni tribes began cooperating with the Iraqi government and even the Americans to rid their territories of foreign fighters, including al-Qaeda in Iraq. By the end of January 2006, the movement had led to the arrest of some 270 foreigners in Anbar province alone. So traumatized was AQI by this experience that to this day, its successors in the Islamic State justify killing opposition Sunnis by branding them as agents of al-Sahwa, Arabic for awakening. During the first few months of 2006, the coalition task force hunting Zarqawi carried out dozens of further raids, killing or arresting hundreds more suspects, including many of Zarqawi's closest lieutenants. On April 16th, the Jordanian was reportedly within a couple of blocks of a safe house in Yusufiya, south of Baghdad, when U.S. Special Forces attacked in the small hours of the morning. The Americans fought room by room, killing five al-Qaeda operatives and arresting five more. Once again, Zarqawi escaped. But one of those detained was familiar with the elaborate security protocol around meetings between Zarqawi and his spiritual advisor, a man known as Sheikh al-Rahman. After a few days of questioning, the prisoner divulged what would prove to be a critical piece of intelligence. Whenever he went to see Zarqawi, the man said, Rahman would change cars a number of times. But when he climbed into a small blue car, his next stop would be with the Jordanian. As the noose tightened, Zarqawi's behavior became increasingly neurotic. He spouted hadith nonstop and followed more and more closely what he took to be the personal habits of Muhammad, down to cleaning his teeth with a twig, scenting his body with musk, and keeping to what he believed were the same waking and sleeping hours as the Prophet. Zarqawi's carefully cultivated tough guy pose was beginning to wear thin. After the Yusufiya raid, the United States released a captured blooper reel from his April video message showing him wearing black pajamas with white New Balance sneakers and a black do-rag, amateurishly swinging a loaded machine gun around and requiring the assistance of a masked helper to perform the elementary operation of clearing the weapons chamber. On June 7th, the coalition's eyes in the sky spotted Rahman getting into a small blue car, just as the man captured in Yusufiya had said he would. Rahman was driven to Hibhib, a village north of Baghdad, where he went into a steel-frame concrete house in the middle of a date palm plantation. A satellite phone trace confirmed that the Jordanian was there. As there was no time to lose, American F-16s, already patrolling above, were scrambled to deliver the killing blow. One of them dropped laser and satellite-guided bombs, collectively weighing half a ton, reducing the building to dust almost instantaneously. Zarqawi and Rahman, coalition sources told the media, would have had no warning of the strike. Yet incredibly, when Delta Force commandos reached the site, Zarqawi was still alive and semi-conscious. Feebly, he struggled to escape, but the soldiers strapped him to a gurney. Inside his battered body, the tissue of his lungs had been fatally bruised and ripped in the blast. Blood sputtered from his mouth. Then his heart gave out. Zarqawi's fresh corpse was taken to the nearby Balad Air Base for identification and post-mortem examination. An American commander delivered an epitaph of sorts over the blasted body, saying laconically, "That's one dead son of a bitch." The wedding of the martyr and hero Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, read a white banner above a tent sheltering several dozen gray plastic patio chairs. The wedding in question, on a street in Zarqa, Jordan, was between the dead terrorist and the several dark-eyed companions, chaste as virgin pearls, whose company he was, even now, supposedly enjoying in the afterlife. In truth, even in Zarqawi's native city, opinion on him was divided. While some residents did indeed regard him as a hero, others castigated him as a thug who brought shame on their town. "May God burn him in hell," one of them told an American reporter. No doubt the feelings of the Al-Qaeda leadership were similarly mixed. Zarqawi's own wife had described her husband as nothing more than a soldier in the ranks of bin Laden's armies, while Osama bin Laden pronounced himself deeply saddened, calling Zarqawi a lion in Islam and a role model for future generations. In reality, given all the trouble he had caused, Al-Qaeda probably hoped never to see an operative like him again. They could have wished for more biddable underlings. Shortly before Zarqawi died, a Jordanian official had predicted there is no such thing as Zarqawism. What Zarqawi is will die with him. Unfortunately, this proved false. As distasteful and brutal as it may be, there was such a thing as Zarqawism, and it endured long after its author sputtered his last breath on a stretcher in Habib. Zarqawi had wanted to foment sectarian violence, and by the time of his death he had succeeded in doing so on a massive scale. The years 2006 and 2007 would prove the bloodiest since the conflict began, a record that has not been surpassed, despite the excesses of the Islamic State. In particular, Zarqawi's wanton destruction of the Golden Mosque had triggered a chain reaction of revenge and counter-revenge that claimed the lives of thousands of people. As the then commander of U.S. Special Forces General Stanley McChrystal lamented, "We had killed Zarqawi too late." And what of the other components of Zarqawi's agenda? The creation of a new caliphate? That would take longer, to be sure. But the form, if not the reality, was in place soon after his death. In October 2006, Al-Qaeda in Iraq again joined with other jihadi groups to form the Islamic State of Iraq and pledge bayat to Amir Abu Omar al-Baghdadi. This was the same group that would become the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant in 2013, and simply the Islamic State in 2014, when it proclaimed itself the reborn caliphate. Through every stage in its life cycle, Zarqawi's ideology of murderous rage and blind hatred has been the organization's lifeblood. Its magazine, Dabiq, takes its name from a saying attributed to Zarqawi that is reproduced on the masthead of every issue. The Islamic State's official spokesman, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, a Syrian who pledged bayat to Zarqawi in the very earliest days of the conflict, describes his mentor's pronouncements as the definitive word on Shia Muslims. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the Islamic State's second leader and first caliph, traces a direct line from Tawhid wal-Jihad through Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Mujahideen Shura Council to the Islamic State. "The path that Zarqawi trod," he has written, "those who came after him followed its course. And we, God willing, are following in their footsteps. They have drawn for us a way that doesn't recognize borders and sketched for us a methodology that doesn't belong to a nation or race. And its journey of ascent does not stop." "This is the story of the whole war," said one of the U.S. intelligence operators responsible for hunting down Zarqawi. "Kill this one guy, and it will make things all better. I still don't understand where this notion comes from."